The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent sports. Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we'll be talking with the great, and I mean the great, Jeff Daniels, who is as good an actor as we have working in this country right now. But before we get started with Jeff, you've heard me talking about Gillette for a few weeks now, but they have been part of my daily routine for as long as I can remember. They are a truly great brand and a great shave. Right now, I'm using the Pro Glide, and I'm a fan of the Fusion Gel Cream as well. You know what you're getting each time you use it, and that's a great shave. Gillette has great news that makes it an even better experience. You can now get Gillette Performance delivered right to your door. Save time, save money. Subscribe today and get every fourth order free. Check out Gillette online at www.gilletteondemand.com. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast, and I am joined today by, and I know the guy a little bit from New York. We were on a few talk shows together, and I believe Jeff Daniels is as gifted a working actor as I know about right now because of the depth and the breadth of the characters he has done in his career. He first came to my attention, and I think the attention of most people, with Terms of Endearment. And right now, we were just talking before we started, he is starring in a show on Hulu called The Looming Tower, about the run-up to 9/11 and the fascinating guy in the center of that, a former FBI guy named John O'Neill. And I'm afraid, because I'm only three episodes into the six that they've released so far, that you're going to say something that's going to, I'm going to need a spoiler alert on. But man, Jeff, it is great.
Well, thank you. I won't spoil anything because what happens was one of the reasons I was all in, because I had no idea what went on leading up to 9/11 and also what happened to John O'Neill. It just stunned me. So it gets better as far as that goes, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know, it's as a New Yorker, I knew about John O'Neill. I love the fact that about the fourth scene of this thing, he's in Elaine's, because he was an Elaine's guy. And but it, Jeff, you set it up. It's basically, and I don't want to oversimplify this, it is a turf war between the FBI and the CIA, and John O'Neill is screaming that Bin Laden is coming for us, but there is not the amount of information sharing that should have gone on in the 2 or 3 years leading up to the bombing.
All of that, the CIA, the CIA and the FBI, I came to find out, I didn't know, was like the Rangers versus the Islanders in the 70s.
Yeah.
It was the Giants and the Jets. It was Michigan, Ohio State. They just didn't like each other. They also went about their business differently. The CIA tends to follow informants and gather information on them, maybe turn them over to being informants, but they follow these guys. Their argument against the FBI is the FBI comes in and just raids them and arrests them, and they don't get all the information out of them they could. The FBI would challenge that. But basically, that was the problem. John O'Neill of the FBI wanted the CIA to move on Bin Laden now, and he was basically just a guy living in a tent in Afghanistan with a bunch of followers around. He hadn't done anything yet. But O'Neill was the guy saying, I'm telling you, watch this guy, I'm on him, I'm telling you, and no one would pay attention.
This is going to sound like an obvious question to you, but I'd rather have you answer it. I mean, there are obvious reasons for anybody who watches this movie that, you know, the character played by the head CIA guy, the played by Peter Sarsgaard, is a composite character. And I think anybody who even starts watching this will know why. But O'Neill was quite real, and a cowboy of the first rank, and a womanizer, and a drinker, and, you know, a pinky ring and a wedding ring that comes on and on. And it just, To me, he's one of the outsized characters, even including Will McAvoy in the newsroom, you've ever played.
Oh, and that was the big one of the big lures to doing it was that I hadn't done anybody this out there, this hard on his sleeve. McAvoy was loud, and he could get, you know, I mean, but it was a different. They were just different. O'Neill really was a bull in a china shop. And I hadn't done that street thing. There's a street element to John O'Neill.
Oh, boy,
that you take it down into Washington, which doesn't have a... And John doesn't have a political bone in his body. He's, his FBI agents, his partners, whom I talked to pretty extensively, said he would kill for the guy, for the men and women in the field of the FBI. He was difficult to be around. His personal life was a white-hot mess. But, man, when it came down to, you know, getting what his people needed, he went to war on that. And it just, he burned bridges to do it. And in the end, it cost him.
We're talking to Jeff Daniels, who is starring right now in The Looming Tower on Hulu. And if you have not yet started, and Jeff, here's the thing. I'm not a binge-watching guy. I mean, my wife does it all the time. And now I'm so hooked on this, and almost the first time we see you in this, and when you come into that room, and it's suck me, Bobby, and all that fast stuff that I got so used to on the newsroom, I'm thinking, okay, this guy is totally in his element with this character.
It fell in pretty good, and a lot of that had to do with the research and these guys kind of explaining that they knew John, but they didn't, and it was a fascinating guy to play because he was so complex. A wife, two girlfriends are in the series, but there were more. He was just searching for something all the time, and yet there was an insecurity, and then the FBI came after him, and he was the hero. But he had a lot wrong with him, and those are the fun guys to play.
Talking to Jeff Daniels on the Mike Lubega podcast, and again, Jeff plays John O'Neill, a fascinating and again, I don't want to say too much about him because there will, Jeff, you know, people will come to this and not know how John O'Neill's life plays out once they start rooting for him, because it's impossible not to root for him in the first episode. And I think I saw you and Peter with Chuck Todd. I think that's the interview I saw, or maybe it was with Stephen Colbert, and tell the story about the memento that was given to you after the movie was seen by people who knew John.
Yeah, Ali Sufan is played by Tahar Rahim, who's he's always in his 20s, and Ali was John O'Neill's partner, and he was a Muslim American, and he joined the FBI. And he became one of the 8 Arabic speakers that they had in the bureau in 1995 or whenever we started. I mean, just a lack of any understanding of what was going on in the Arab world at all. And here comes this guy. He grooms this kid who turns in to be a hell of an agent. And so I met with Ali Sufan as part of the research for this. We shoot the series over 5 months. He sees it, and at the end of the day, that's the review. That's the one I need.
Right.
And everything else is a bonus. And he saw the opening. We had a premiere in New York where they showed, I think, the first 2 episodes. And I saw Ali Sufan afterwards. And I said, how'd I do? And he came up to me and he handed me a pin from John O'Neill's memorial, because John's no longer with us.
Right.
And he said, words to the effect, John would have been very happy. And gave me that pin. And,
oh, boy.
You know, it's all the review I need. That's the best review I'll ever get.
Again, we're talking to Jeff Daniels on the Gillette Hotline. And once you start watching this, I'm telling you, it's as good as anything. Obviously, Jeff is made for this role. But, Jeff, what a cast. Tahar Rahim, Bill Camp is great in this.
Lewis, Michael Stuhlbarg,
Louis Cancelmi, who played like one of the worst people ever on Blue Bloods, I think it was last year, is terrific. And one of my favorite actresses with whom you have a couple of great scenes early is Annie Parise, who used to be in Law and Order. There's a scene where O'Neill is talking about his Catholicism. He's sitting at a restaurant table with Annie Parisi, and this is a guy, again, wife, two girlfriends, going to pretty much at the same time, and is quoting to her about why he no longer receives communion at Mass on Sundays.
Yeah, he was raised a very strict Catholic, Jesuit school, the whole deal, and then, you know, just started living large and didn't need the church anymore. But he's basically a lost soul, and she helps him come back to the church, which is another way of she helps him straighten out a little bit near the end. She's a good influence on him. She really was.
And there's a scene that really encapsulizes what we're talking about with this story. And again, this turf war between and this lack of sharing of information that could have literally changed American history. And I think it's Louis Kinselmi, I think it's in episode 3, who says, these motherfuckers don't get that we're all on the same team. And that's Jeff, that's pretty much what we're talking about with this story in the run-up to September 11th.
Yeah, and it leads into today. You know, are we all on the same team? Because look what happened when we weren't. And 9/11 happened. And are we better off? And I think that's one of the things that resonates now, 18 or so years later, of people watching this thing. They're looking at, you know, people that were the best and the brightest were working in the government. And you may not have liked Clinton, you may not have liked Bush and Cheney, but you had every office had someone in it, and every department was fully staffed. And you had a lot of brilliant, knowledgeable experts in all of their fields in every department, including the CIA and the FBI. People don't get along, and that was a problem. I read something where John Brennan, the former CIA director, I believe, now says that they share intelligence a lot better now, partly because of 9/11, but because the stakes are so high. And now you look around, and where's brilliant, knowledgeable, and experts in their field? Where are they? They're not in this White House. So I think people are really looking at this going, could this happen again? Because of the chaos and all that. So I think that's part of why the show is resonating, is that we're in such a precarious predicament now.
Talking to Jeff Daniels on the Gillette Hotline. Jeff, how long ago did you first read this script? And did you decide after that or decide after your own research into O'Neill that this was a guy you had to play?
No, I jumped in. I read the first episode, just the first episode. It was February, and we started shooting May 1st. And I remember I was at the Writers Guild Awards, and I had introduced Aaron Sorkin. He was getting a Life Achievement Award.
Right.
And that was a great honor to introduce Aaron. And then I went back up to the hotel room after that, and the agent called and said, I'm sending you something right now. They're going to make an offer tomorrow. And I read it, and of course the subject matter was of interest. That it was based on true people and true events was interest. And then I had no idea how to play the guy was the third one. I'm going, I've never done this. I don't know how to, you know, again, this had a lot to do with the street element of him. He was smart, but not Will McAvoy smart. It was interesting. And so I committed after just the first episode. And then I got the book and was, you know, the next day found out what happens
leading
up to 9/11. And I said, oh, my God, I have to do this. So I spent too much. Then I went to work. Said yes and went to work.
Jeff, and in so many ways, you know, this, because of O'Neill, it's a New York cop story at its heart. When O'Neill is over in Manchester with the, I'm sorry, I don't know the actor's name, from Scotland Yard.
Barry James is the character, yeah.
he's terrific.
He's right out of Ireland, yeah.
And O'Neill at one point just says, we're looking for a guy. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is, he's really looking, in this case, he's looking for a foot soldier. But That's what O'Neal's doing. He's looking for a guy named Bin Laden. And you know, as the story plays out, you know, I saw one Washington Post story about O'Neal where it says that he set out to get Bin Laden. And in a lot of big ways, Bin Laden ended up getting him.
Larry Wright, the guy who wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Larry said that. And it was, I hadn't thought about that ever. And when he said that, I'm going, bingo, there it is.
And Jeff, you know, you live in Michigan now. You are a Michigander, but you spent a lot of time in your life in New York City, and I have a feeling that was another thing that made this material resonate with you.
Yeah, I was in New York for 10 years before I moved back to Michigan, and we have an apartment back there, so we love the city. We go in for. I go to New York City to relax, believe it or not. The most over-caffeinated city, the city that doesn't sleep, that's where I go to relax. It has to do with the salad days and eating in diners and walking around on the Upper West Side and nobody knowing who I am. It's kind of a nice place for me. But, you know, it's shot in New York City, and anything that shoots in New York City gets my attention. You know, I love working there. I live, I have the apartment there. That was a big reason. What happened to New York City, as well as the Pentagon and the other flights, the Pennsylvania. It was such an important subject.
Yeah.
That maybe now, with time away from it, we can look back on it now without the emotional hurt, without that wish for vengeance that we all had the next day. Who do we get? Who do we go get? And 20 years later, it's what did we learn from it?
We're talking to Jeff Daniels on the Gillette Hotline. My dear friend and one of my writing heroes, Pete Hamill, had the greatest line about.
Oh, I love Pete Hamill.
Oh, he's the best. He's 83 years old now and still plugging away. He's moved back to Brooklyn.
Now, Pete Hamill wrote for, back in the 70s, you wrote for the Daily News.
Right. And
you were my religious go-to guy every morning.
Well, thank you.
Sports.
You
really were. And Pete was writing, was it the Post?
Well, Pete had started at the Post in the 1960s, and then he did novels and movies and all that stuff. And then
he wrote the novels, yeah.
We actually started at the Daily News on the same day in 1977, and he had always been, he and Breslin were my two heroes, and then I ended up working.
Oh, my God, yeah, I moved to New York in 76, and I read you guys, yeah.
Yeah, well, Jeff, we kind of arrived in the city the same time, and I know you're a newspaper. I think the last time I saw you in person, I think we ran into each other at Sarah Beth's up on the Upper West Side, and it was during the newsroom, and I said, I think it was before the last season, and I said, well, how's the last year looking? And I think you told me three episodes. I said, well, wait a minute. And I said, only three? And you said, that's all Aaron had left.
Well, it ended up being six. But, yeah, there was a negotiation to how many in the last season, yeah. Aaron ran that show, yeah.
And so anyway, I was going to tell you about Pete. And Pete has always said that New York did not show its greatness on September 11th. He said New York showed its greatness on September 12th and September 13th. And Jeff, the image he's always used is a prize fighter getting laid out and then slowly getting to one knee and then slowly gathering himself and then slowly getting up. That's what happened in the shadow of 9/11.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah.
You know, and I know that when you were thinking in those days, how someday can I get back to Mike and it would be doing this podcast today? No. But Jeff, you know that I tried to do this podcast a couple of years ago, except our dear friend, Scott Frank, dare I say, tried to kill you during the filming of Godless.
He almost did. He made every effort. I had done a movie with Scott called The Lookout with Joe Gordon-Levitt 15 years ago. And so he calls up and he says, look, Godless, it's Western, you be the bad guy. I read it. I'm going, it's Scott Frank. The guy is such a great writer and director. And I said, I'm in. And again, didn't really know what I was going to do, but Scott said, let's figure it out together. So we did. And I had to learn how to ride a horse because it's a Western, and it's not a Western where you can fake it. It's galloping right. and shooting, and, yeah. you know, you got to look like you can ride up a tree in the horse. I trained in Michigan with a guy for about 3 months, so that by the time I went to New Mexico to shoot this thing, I was okay. I could stay on the horse. I could gallop. I could do the thing. I mean, I wasn't going to enter the Kentucky Derby, but I could get around.
Yeah.
And much better than the other four actors from L.A. who said they do the standard actor thing. Can you ride? Absolutely. And yeah. You lie. And so they show up and they go, teach me how to ride in 3 days. Well, the first take of the first day of the first scene, we're coming up a ridge and galloping 200 yards, 30 horses across. I'm, of course, leading. And you've got wranglers on each side of every actor whose only job is to save our ass when we fly off the horse.
Right.
They're dressed as outlaws, but they are bird-dogging us. And so we're galloping, and we get to the end of the first take, and I make it. I get to the mark. I spin the horse. I'm there. I feel like a hero. Already you can see the ambulance driving, which is, they're going, one of the actors flew off the back of the horse and, you know, probably a concussion, landed on the ground. You know you're in a Western when they say action and the ambulance starts its engine. That's when Scott walked over to me and he said, just stay on the fucking horse and walk away. And I tried. I really tried. And I fell off, over the 3 months, I fell off the horse 3 times. And twice, once at a gallop. And the other time was we had a scene, Jack O'Connell and I had a scene where we were getting hung. And it was the second to last day of shooting in December. It was 2 degrees. And it was Santa Fe and the wind, and it was 10 below wind chill and all of that. And I have to get on a bareback horse. First of all, I talk about the horse, and then I make the horse lay down on the ground like a dog. And the horse trained to do that, but it looks like I did it. I get the horse down on the ground. I do a bunch of Scott Frank speeches, and then I do that, and I get on the horse, and up we go, bareback. The horse is supposed to spin around, cut. The horse gets up, spins around, sees Colorado, and goes. So now I jump off the horse. I'm going, to hell with this. Jump off the horse. Land on my left wrist. Ouch, that hurts. Finish shooting the day. So you should see a doctor. Go see the doctor. The Santa Fe doctor says you've got a compound fracture of your wrist, probable nerve damage, surgery more than likely. You need to see an orthopedic surgeon tomorrow morning. I said, well, we got one more day of shooting, and it's the last day, and they're running out of money, and they're going to California, and that's it. Well, I'm not going to let you do that. Well, thanks a lot, Doc. I'm going to work tomorrow. So, like the old school guy I am, I show up and go to work. I'm on so much morphine because of the pain. I'm riding the morphine like it's, you know, Woodstock. And I'm standing there. I remember doing the scene. But by that point, by the time we were shooting, the morphine had worn off, and I was in such severe pain because I was bleeding internally. It was just a mess. And it was like Lazarus coming out of the trailer, limping on one leg because I thought I'd also torn my knee in the jump, and also holding my wrist like, you know, a wounded bird. And I hope to work with Scott again, but, you know, not on a horse.
Not on a Western. You know, my recollection is that Scott Frank, who, by the way, and I want to talk about another Michigander for a second, Elmore Leonard, who's one of my best friends. But
Elmore Leonard, yeah.
And he wrote Out of Sight and Get Shorty, and Scott did. But my recollection is he was in New Mexico for freaking ever. We were actually trying to get a pilot off the ground at that point, and he was in New Mexico, and it was left to me to pitch it, and I swear to God, it was godless. It was the reason that thing didn't end up getting made. But wasn't he there for like 9 months or something?
Oh, yeah. Easily. I think they started shooting in, June. He certainly was there for 3 months before that with pre-production, and he finished shooting in December. Yeah, most of the year.
Jeff Daniels, currently starring in The Looming Tower on Hulu, is our guest on the Mike Lupica podcast. More with Jeff right after this from Audible. Audiobooks are great for helping you be a better you. Whether you want to learn something new or get motivated, I was listening to a book on my way to a spring training game this morning. You can check out books like The 4-Hour Workweek or The Power of Habit. Audible helps you listen to more books by making it easy to switch between devices. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and listen at any time, even if you cancel. Start a 30-day trial with Audible and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/CH today. You can browse the unmatched selection of audio programs, download a title free, and start listening. Go to audible.com/CH today or text CH today to 500-500 to get started. We're talking to Jeff Daniels on the Mike Lupica podcast and on the Gillette Hotline. How long were you in New Mexico? But by the way, people ought to see it. Jeff plays a badass criminal named Frank Griffin, who is hunting down his former protege and ends up in a town run by women. It's actually a great story. But how long were you there?
I got in there on Labor Day and left in December. Yeah, I was there 3 months. Yeah, a little over 3 months.
And you once said that if you brought all the characters you played together, you would like to have Frank Griffin talking to Harry Dunn from Dumb and Dumber when the subject of Will McAvoy came up.
Yeah. And then McAvoy sits down because there's nowhere else to sit. Now they're at the same table, the three of them. What's Jeff, that conversation like?
Jeff, of all the obviously terms of endearment, you know, is a game changer for you because it was such a big movie at the time. But Dumb and Dumber, it seems to me that you have to have a soft place in your heart for that because it was huge. And that's a different kind of game changer, is it not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, terms of endearment certainly got me into the movie business. It was the foot in the door, and it was a hell of a foot with Jim Brooks and Deborah and Shirley and Jack Nicholson. I mean, I'm surrounded by superstars, so that was glad to be included. That started everything else, but Dumb and Dumber was the one where I went from walking through an airport in Atlanta from, to Jeff Daniels. You know, that's when the name recognition happened because it was Dumb and Dumber was everywhere. It was just everywhere.
It was.
Dumb and Dumber is I've always said to critics, the Greeks were holding up two masks. And, I know I sat on a toilet and I did that. But, you know, there's value in comedy. Otherwise, the Greeks wouldn't have said it was so important. And it certainly helps get us through life, that's for sure, a laugh here and there. I remember going to Walter Reed Hospital a couple of times. You know, as a celebrity, as you know, you get in the area and they flag you down and they go, you want to come talk to some soldiers? And Iraq was going on at the time, and I saw about 20 of them up and down the hall. And some of them had just been blown up 3 days ago. And they were to Germany, and now they're here, and they're 3 days wounded, and badly wounded. Things are missing. And every single one of them was happy to talk about Dumb and Dumber. Not because they're stupid.
Right.
Uneducated. You could see it. Make me laugh. Please, God, make me laugh. And I've always remembered that. You know, I've always remembered what Dumb and Dumber did for people like that who needed something very, very badly.
When we started this today, I was talking about your range, and I'm not talking about, if people have heard me say this, and I've written this before, the range is what is striking about your career. You know, when I go back over your stuff, I looked at the list on IMDb, and I had forgotten, and I saw it and loved it, because I thought it was a perfect role for you. You once played Steve Merrick in the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial, which is one of my favorite stories in the history of stories.
Yeah. Yeah, that was Robert Altman.
Yep, I know. I was Chicago. I'd forgotten that, too.
Well, but that was, I mean, working with Altman was, I mean, that was, he was one of the greats. Maybe not as recognized as some of the other great directors in American film history, but man, that guy was, he was rock and roll. I mean, he made you, He'd send three people through the door that only fit two people and go, rolling, action, see what happens. I mean, he's one of those guys. He made stuff happen in front of the camera. Clint Eastwood does the same thing. Caine Mutiny Court Martial. I think it was for CBS. And, it was a good group.
Oh, man, that was good.
Brad Davis, and we had a good group. Eric Bogosian.
You know, as I go through the list, but there are ones that jump out and are like points of light. And one of them, and again, one of my all-time favorite movies is The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a turning point. I was 30. Terms of Endearment, I was 28, so 2 years later. Terms of Endearment certainly opened a door for things like Something Wild and Purple Rose. But I got to be in a Woody Allen movie at a time when Woody was the great American filmmaker, certainly one of them.
Right.
And you're handed the script and you find out you're playing two leading roles in a Woody Allen comedy.
Right.
And that's it, and you're 30 years old. That was when I decided to stay in the business.
Had you considered not staying in the business?
Oh, yeah, daily.
Oh,
yearly.
Really?
And there was an assessment every year. I moved to New York. I was 21, and I was married. At the time I did Purple Rose, I had a 1 or 2 year old boy, maybe, not even one. And a wife. And I just was going, I don't know if I can sustain this. Maybe Terms of Endearment was kind of it. And then I get the Woody Allen thing. And then halfway through the movie, Woody Allen gets word to me that I'm good. Tell him he's good. And that goes a long way. And that's when I said, I'm going to stick around. Because if I'm good enough for Woody Allen at the top of his game, then I'm probably good enough for anybody. And I should ride that and hang on to that. I always tell kids, you know, a young actor starting out, you got to believe in yourself. You got to, it probably applies to anything, but you got to believe in yourself because you're the only one who does. If you're going to go to New York or L.A., you're it. And then you pick up people along the way who also believe in you. And it may be tomorrow or maybe a year from now, but you got to be patient. You got to grab those people. And Woody Allen was one of those guys when I was 30. Tell him he's good. All I needed to hear. A year later, I was auditioning for Heartburn with Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, and I went up to Mike Nichols' apartment where he was holding meetings, and I met with Mike, and Mike said, great. I said, do you want me to read? And he looked at me and said, you're good enough for Woody, you're good enough for me. And that was it.
That was it. You know, my 94-year-old war hero father, he was a bombardier in World War II. He did not know anything about journalism. He said to me one time, you better promote yourself because if you don't, nobody else will. And it's
right.
Kind of the same thing. It's kind of the same thing that you're saying. And
you can see it now. It's different now with Twitter and social media. And I'm sure there's a way to do it, just like my generation figured out the way to do it, is how to promote yourself and how to sell yourself and market yourself, and whether you're a star or whether you're an actor, whether you have talent or whether you're trying to get by on little talent, you're putting your best foot, you're deciding who you are and what you are, and then running with that. Today, man, oh man, it's just, you can just see it. And maybe it's because you get older and you go, you know, I think I'm going to check out of Ambition Hotel here for a while. And it's a nice thing. I mean, it certainly helps that Newsroom and Looming Tower and Godless and those things are coming. Because, I mean, without that frontier of cable television, which is where all the writing is gone, which is where actors go, they chase writing. Without that frontier, I'd be out. I'd be done. But because it's there, it's I'm able to kind of let them come to me now, which in my fifth decade is just, that's not how they draw it up in star school, you know. Don't worry, you're going to really hit when you're in your late 50s, you know. That's not how it goes. But today's kids, man, I mean, just the Twitter and the social media presence and all of that, it's very, very noisy out there, very noisy. It's hard to get noticed. Real hard to get noticed. Jack Lemmon told me once, and Jack said, kid, you got to be different. Whatever you got to do, you know, it's good to be a little bit strange. You don't walk in there and do the audition with a corn cob pipe. I said, Jack, a corn cob pipe? What are you talking about? He goes, you got to be different. Nobody else will have a corn cob pipe. You go in there with a corn cob pipe and do whatever it is with the corn. They'll remember you. Okay, thanks, Jack.
By the way, I'm probably doing the newsroom conversation in reverse, but I'm starting with the end. And I was just wondering, that scene where you're playing and singing at the end of Newsroom, was that a collaborative vision between you and Aaron?
Only in that he knew I could do that. I mean, I've been playing guitar, acoustic guitar, and in clubs for... in public since like 2003 or 2004, something like that. I just thought that's where I'd end up. I didn't think the acting career would last, and I was learning how to do that. I really admired people like Steve Goodman and Arlo Guthrie and Christine Lavin and, you know, people like that who could just go on stage with a guitar. I was perfectly happy to spend act three of my life doing that. So Aaron knew I could do that going in. He researched me. And so I remember going in the first season, we did the first scene in Will McAvoy's apartment. It was a place they rented in downtown L.A. And there were two guitars on stands. I said, oh. I said, Aaron, you know, I can do that. And he goes, yeah, I know you can. And about six episodes later, there's a song with me and Johnny Gallagher at some party at McAvoy's, and we're doing a song. And Aaron's a romantic theater, musical theater.
I happen to know that. Somebody told me he will burst into show tunes.
I have not seen that, but I believe that. But he's a fan of musicals. So by the time we get around to the final episode, he pulls out the old, let's do... I think it was a Tom T. Hall song, something about Memphis, and there it is in the script, and you're going, great, terrific, great. Anytime you can pick up a guitar and throw a camera on me, I'm okay.
We're talking with the gifted actor Jeff Daniels on the Mike Lupica podcast. More with Jeff in a minute, but first, a word from GEICO. When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money. How does Newsroom come into your life? Because, again, in a career of game changers, and this is before you play John Scully and Steve Jobs, how does Newsroom and that, you know, my dear friend Bill Goldman always says, he talks about what will be in the first paragraph of your obit. Well, I don't know if it'll be the first. Will McAvoy might not be in the first paragraph, but it's sure going to be high up in the story.
Well, that Northwestern speech will outlive me and Aaron. It just will, and we didn't see that coming. That'll certainly be in the obit. The acting career was slowing down. I just wasn't happy with it, and I really thought it had run its course. And we were looking at television. I had a script with Tim Busfield, who of 30-something and many other things. He's a director now, hell of a director. Tim and I had a script or a series that we'd written, and we took it around. We shopped it. We pitched it. A couple of them came after it, and we signed with one of the cable networks. And they developed this half-hour series for 6 months, which is a lot of time to spend on 30 pages. Finally, I'm going, whatever. And they're going, look, we're going to make a decision here by February 1st because that's your deadline. I said, yeah, it's the deadline because pilot season starts after that, and we need to know if you're going to do this or not. And they said, we think it's absolutely brilliant. We're going to pass. I said, terrific. Welcome to Hollywood. So I said, I'm going shopping on Monday on February 1st for something else. They're going, well, we might bring it back in the spring. I said, okay, well, then pay me not to go shopping. I said, no, we're not going to do that. I said, well, then I'm going shopping. And we knew that Sorkin and Scott Rudin and HBO had something called the Newsroom. And we were going to at least throw our hat in there because Aaron at that time, that month, was campaigning to eventually win an Oscar for Social Network. So he was busy, and he was going to get to it at the end of the month. So we got our hat in there and went right to the top of the list. And I met with Aaron a few weeks later in New York, and I had it before the breakfast was over. And we were talking about who's the girl, you know?
Yep.
So I called the agent and said, I got it. And they're going, okay, don't get ahead of yourself. No, no, no. I got it. You understand? I have it. I'm playing Milo McAvoy. You'll see. And the phone rang later, and here comes the offer. And so we called the other cable network and said, you know, Jeff just signed with HBO to do Newsroom there in Sorkin. And they said, we'll green light his pilot right now.
Yeah.
We said, thank you very much for your belated interest and went and did Newsroom. But I'll tell you, sometimes it's fate and timing. And, you know, if they had said, we're going to pick up your little series and basically hang on to it and then discard you like, you know, so many of them do, I never would have done Newsroom.
I'm talking to Jeff Daniels on the Gillette Hotline, and Jeff Daniels to me is the equivalent of a five-tool baseball player who is absolutely at the top of his game right now. If you have not seen The Looming Tower yet on Hulu, I encourage you to start watching it tonight. But leave yourself some time, because I think there's six of them out now, Jeff. And so Newsroom, I just want to stay on Newsroom for one more second.
Yeah.
And before we stop today, we have to talk about politics, because I've blundered
sure.
into that. I always tell people, somebody came up to me in the airport today in West Palm Beach and said, oh, I saw you on MSNBC last night. And I says, yes, if you see me on MSNBC, which you do more frequently now, that just means it was a day when they ran out of smart people. And, you know, that Jeff, no, I say to him, they have a list of really smart people. And if they're all booked that day, they say, I think we can get Mike from, like, you know, the next list down, because I got four kids and I couldn't sit out what's been happening.
And there's an art to doing that, as you know. I mean, you sit on that panel.
Yeah.
Like you've done. When we sat with Chuck Todd. You better know what you're talking about.
Yes.
And these people do. These are all the poli-sci majors that are now on television. I mean, they're in hog heaven talking about Trump and everything else. This is just like they're overdosing on political science. And you know, they're also very, very, very smart people. I'm learning a lot every night, because that's my go-to drama is MSNBC. What's going on now?
You know? Right. All the way through Brian Williams at 11 o'clock. I got to ask you about one of my favorite actors who you've now worked with more than once and was part of the heart of the Newsroom. And that is Sam Waterston. Jeff, he's absolutely brilliant in everything he does.
And a great guy. I've known Sam since the 70s. We did a ill-received production of the Chekhov's The Three Sisters off Broadway in 1982, I think, 83,
yeah.
Something like that. But yeah, he loves the theater and he loves acting, and he was a great sounding board for me, because he had spent 16 years on Law and Order, Newsroom being my first series. You know, it's a new game, and so I was really glad he was around, and not that I would, you know, help me, Sam, help me, but it was just good to have someone who'd been through it. There were days deep in a series where you've memorized 9 episodes of Aaron Sorkin dialogue,
right.
And your computer needs more memory; it's overloaded, and we called it getting Sorkinized. You just had so much information
yeah.
that had to go in, shoot it, get it out, put in the new stuff. I mean, it was like studying for finals for 7 straight months. And there were times where you just took a knee. I remember just taking a knee in the middle of the newsroom. And Sam came over and goes, Sam goes, you okay? And I go, no, I'm not. He goes, just tell him you need to go home. And I need to go home and go to bed and stop trying to remember lines. And they go home. You've been Sorkinized.
We're talking to Jeff Daniels. I've been waiting to do this podcast. Unfortunately, during Godless, my friend Scott Frank tried to kill him.
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about politics for a second
yeah.
before it makes both of our heads explode. Jeff, as a Michigander, were you in that state the night of the election? Because I remember as the panic starts to set in, as the night starts to take that turn from which it never recovered. And I remember calling Mike Barnicle, my friend from MSNBC, yeah. And I said, I swear to God, this is how pathetic it had gotten. Can Oakland County save her? Jeff, I swear to God I did. And Barnicle said,
Oakland County or Macomb County, they've both got to come through. It's down to 28 people in Michigan. Yeah.
And I'm losing my shit. And he said, if we're waiting for Oakland County to save her, she's not going to get saved tonight.
That's right. We were in Santa Fe, New Mexico, shooting godless.
Oh, God, is that right?
So we're in the Paris of the Southwest. Right. There are art galleries every 20 feet. It's Hillary country. And we're sitting in Scott Frank's rented house, about 20 of us from the crew and actors, watching this happen. And they all know I'm from Michigan. And about two-thirds of the way through, when it looks like it's getting tighter, they're starting to look at me going, what's going to happen to Michigan? What's going to happen? I said, I don't know. It's a labor state. It's never gone. We haven't gone Republican since '88. I mean, I think we're fine. We're fine. And yeah. Then you're sitting there, and it happens, and you just go. You leave. You finish shooting godless with a broken wrist.
Right.
Now you go back to Michigan, and you sit down with some of the people you know around here, and you go, "Can you believe the election?"
Yeah,
and they turn to you and they go, yeah, isn't it great? And you go, oh, my God, someone wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
And a lot of the white manufacturing males and black manufacturing males, but the manufacturing males and females who lost their jobs to China and Mexico are angry. They're angry, and they don't know who's representing them. And Trump told them what they wanted to hear. I hate to say it, but they were conned.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they're desperate. They got families. They're trying to get a paycheck, and the jobs are leaving. And you know, he says they're going to come back. They're going to come back as robots, but whatever. I'll bring them back. So on they go. He also, you know, when people get that scared and that frightened and they're looking at the bottom, if not already there, they start blaming people.
Yep.
And Carol Anderson wrote a great book, White Rage versus Black Advancement. And when you're at the bottom, you know, and you're a white manufacturing male who's tried to do the right thing, and, you know, next thing you know, you're looking at minorities as you're supposed to be on the bottom. And they aren't. And so they get angry. And then he pushes that button. Trump pushed that racist button, and he was off to the races. That's one of the terrible things about what happened. It destroyed what makes America great, and that's compassion for other people.
And when you look at this, and I kept saying, yeah, he's winning the airplane hangars. You know, he's winning those rallies. And
yeah.
But I kept saying, well, there can't possibly be enough votes out there. And then the guy ends up getting 65 million votes. And my question to you is, and it can't be synthesized into a short answer, is when do those people that he conned begin to realize in great numbers that they got conned?
You know, initially, he goes to war.
Right.
And that's what's disturbing now, because Mueller's getting closer. And anyone who says Russia is a hoax hasn't been paying attention to what Donald Trump has done his entire life, which is lie to everyone and cheat people. And that's his M.O. So, you know, we'll wait for the proof. But when that report drops from Mueller, those who are supporting him, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, other Republicans trying desperately to look the other way when he does yet another stupid thing, they're all going to find out that it's all there. It's probably worse than you think.
Yes, I agree.
And in ways that this country has never seen before. I mean, is it treasonous? I don't know the definition, but we're talking about somebody who cons everybody he does. And he conned the American people, and he conned the country, and he's got his arm around Putin. And Robert Mueller is probably going to show us that. And if he doesn't, I'll be the first one to say I'm wrong. But I'm sorry. This is we have been taken. And if he starts a war and they got to bring back the draft, which they won't, but that would do it. All these people are beating their chests and, you know, all of that. Suddenly your son and daughter are going to North Korea. That would change it.
I keep thinking that he is going to do that to change the subject from, you know,
he's the great subject. Absolutely.
And I said yesterday.
When he gets cornered, he isn't cornered yet, but what happens when they indict Jared and they indict Don Jr.?
Oh, 100%, Jeff, 100%. And everybody says, well, wait till he sits down with Mueller. A lawyer said to me yesterday, you don't, if you're Mueller, you don't have to sit down with the guy who is clearly not the, is the target of your investigation. He has stripped away all pretext that he's, you know, he's going to get those other people, but he's after the president of the United States. And I keep thinking he is going to fire Rosenstein and have Mueller fired. And I said this to Ari Melber yesterday on MSNBC. I said, people say that'll precipitate a constitutional crisis. And I said, what, you mean we're not having one already?
Yeah, exactly. I'm watching Lindsey Graham, who is, as a Republican with a district that's probably pro-Trump, is doing everything he can, you know, short of being thrown out of his state, to try to get the guy to turn around. And he has said, if he fires Mueller, which maybe is Rosenstein and then Mueller, but if he fires Mueller, then like I said on Colbert, then it's who are the heroes? Is that what institutes your constitutional crisis, Lindsey, Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, others, Richard Burr? I mean, Trey Gowdy. I'm not impressed with Jeff Flake and Trey Gowdy and guys like that who are resigning.
No, of course not. You're 100% right.
You're running away instead of facing the problem and Bob Corker, and like he did initially, throw yourself at him. If you're not going to need your constituents back in Tennessee, Bob, you know what's wrong. You know what's going on. You've seen the classified reports. You know how involved Russia is.
Before I get off with Jeff Janis, let me just circle back to the Looming Tower. Again, it's on Hulu. It's Jeff at the top of his game. And to put a bow around this, Mr. Daniels, tell me why you're so proud of your participation in this particular event.
Looming Tower is the kind of thing where it's going to resonate with everybody now. It's you know, where we are in the country at 2018. This is what happened on 9/11, 18 years ago or so, 17. This could happen. It's happened already. Can it happen again? And to be in a show that instigates that conversation, that makes people take a look at who we are and what we are and who's representing us, and are we as safe as we possibly can be? Are we being well represented? Because when we aren't, or when people aren't sharing information like they weren't back then between the CIA and FBI, bad things happen. And I think everyone's afraid. And this show illustrates how good people can still end up making mistakes. And are we better off now than we were then? Have we learned anything? And I think that's one of the reasons it resonates.
Thank you for doing this today. I think the first time we ever met was on Conan, and my recollection is that you threatened me over some. I had either made fun of hockey. I think you physically did you not, Mr. Daniels, physically threaten me?
I might have stood and made a fist. You're right. But as I told you, lawyer.
Jeff, congratulations on this. I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. But I like this piece as much as anything you've ever done. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
The great Jeff Daniels on the Mike Lubica podcast. Again, if you have not watched The Looming Tower, do it. This is the kind of conversation we have every single week. Download, subscribe, leave comments, and we'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lubica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lubica podcast. Click on the Mike Lubica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.